This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from a political scientist about the long-term effects of our elections.
And one of the reasons why we have the racial disparities is because the people that are suffering the burden of those poor policy decisions are not represented in their legislatures, and it really is a stain on our democracy.
And we'll learn about the safety precautions in place at the airport used by many on the Central Coast.
Not everyone yet had their own face mask. So in all of our terminals, we pass them out for free. We actually give out about 300 masks per day. If you need one, you'll get one.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 30th. I'm Carol Tangeman. Since the beginning of the pandemic, facilities that care for the elderly have been hotspots for the spread of COVID-19. And a new report says nationwide, new cases in nursing homes have reached record numbers this month. KAZU's Michelle Loxton reports from Monterey County.
When I asked two local healthcare experts what it's like to work in a nursing home right now and cope with the COVID-19 outbreak, their messages follow a theme.
I kind of perceive what's happening to be a trauma for the staff and for the residents.
Absolutely heartbreaking for all of us who worked on it.
Those are the voices of Maggie Pena with Alliance on Aging in Monterey County, followed by Dr. Gail Newell, the health officer for Santa Cruz County. Newell has been involved in a number of outbreaks at both skilled nursing and assisted living facilities in Santa Cruz County.
It happens so quickly in these vulnerable populations.
And outbreaks in these facilities can often be tragic.
The death rate in this population is very high.
Despite the heartbreaking circumstances, Newell is armed with suggestions for these facilities that could help prevent or slow the spread of the coronavirus.
Working actively with the staff to continue to educate them about appropriately donning and doffing, which is the fancy way of saying putting on and taking off their PPE.
Also,
good ventilation is a really big factor.
And
it helps if the facilities are able to offer full-time jobs so the employees don't need to shop around for a second part-time job. But I know that's not always economically feasible.
Employment challenges are a systemic problem, as Maggie Pena, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program Manager with the Alliance on Aging in Monterey County, explains.
Something we've seen across the state of California is just some of these caregivers, they don't even have health insurance.
Pena says healthcare workers are under a huge amount of pressure right now.
They're making less than $20 an hour, sometimes less than $15 an hour. Now they're essentially maybe putting their life at risk by working in a positive facility, or maybe they have family members they're caring for at home.
As an advocate, Pena makes unannounced visits to nursing homes to speak to residents to see what can be improved upon.
You know, when we ask them, what would make you feel better? It's like this pandemic being over, George Clooney coming to visit me in my room. You know, we collected arts and crafts supplies, like crossword puzzles. You know, many of them don't use social media or the internet.
And the isolation that's been put in place to protect residents is actually causing its own problems.
We are all having our own kind of emotional challenges from the isolation, right? But can you imagine that the only people you see are masked?
Pena says they've also noticed a pretty rapid decline in those with dementia because of the isolation. In this case, they actually recommend a compassionate care visit utilizing COVID-19 safety protocols. For Pena, talking about these challenges really does reveal the solutions. And as we head into the holiday season, these two local healthcare experts have these messages about the future of caring for our elderly. Dr. Gail Newell is thinking about the short term.
It's never been more true than at this time and this time of year when we're all craving time and physical touch with our loved ones. And yet it's never been more important to follow these social distancing requirements because of the current surge.
For Maggie Pena, it's about thinking about the long term, too.
I guess my question is, like, how do we redesign safer, more compassionate, and more joyful environments for aging?
A question that's not only on the minds of these healthcare experts, but also the residents, their loved ones, and the staff inside these long-term care facilities.
That was Michelle Loxton of KAZU reporting in Monterey County. Working Lunch is the San Luis Obispo Chamber's weekly conversation with Director Jim D'Antona. Today, guest Michael Lattner of Cal Poly talks with D'Antona about partisanship, polls, and what could change going forward in our country's elections.
In addition to teaching political science at Cal Poly, Michael is also a faculty scholar at the Institute for Advanced Technology and Public Policy and a senior fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists Center for Science and Democracy in Washington, D.C., election law, and social science. His areas of focus are incredibly relevant to our current national conversation and include political participation, campaigns and elections, and voting rights and representation. His previous work on partisan gerrymandering has been cited by the Supreme Court of the United States, and he's currently working on his next book, Gerrymandering the States, Race, Partisanship, and Rewriting of American Federalism, which should be coming out soon. I'm so looking forward to our conversation and digging into the process, participation, polling, and how he got hooked on politics. Mike, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Let's start just kind of in general. How did you first get involved in politics and policy? Were you an early ASB participant, school president?
That's funny you say that. I was in student government, lost my first election, so I learned about politics the hard way. I grew up in a pretty politically active house. My dad was a pipe fitter, and so he was very active in his local labor union. So I grew up in a union home, and then my brother, who's about 10 years older than I am, was a young disciple of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. And so I lived in a sort of politically schizophrenic household, but it provided a great environment to learn about politics and listen to my parents and my brother fight. And then I ended up getting interested in politics myself. I was a pre-law major as an undergrad. And then there really was a one class on public opinion that really turned me on to the science of politics. And that's where I got involved in understanding political behavior and approaching political science from a sort of scientific or engineering perspective. In grad school, I had no plans on actually teaching or being a university professor. My goal was to open up a polling shop. My first job out of college was as a pollster. I worked for the Field Poll for 5 years, which is a legendary research institute in California. Then in grad school, I kind of fell in love with teaching as a profession. It's such a rewarding thing to do. And I also ended up taking some classes from someone whose degree was actually in physics. So this person, Rain Tagapero, was an astrophysicist by training. And I studied political institutions with him. And from there, I really fell passionately in love with the idea of political institutions as structures that shape human behavior. And from there, I went on to look at laws and looking at law from a scientific perspective, more so than a legal perspective. And I've been very involved in electoral reform movements and studying electoral research from a comparative perspective, looking at how the United States is similar and different from other countries and you know, what sets us apart from other political systems.
We've seen some inflammatory headlines claiming that the polling industry missed it again, but did they really, or is there any significant change that's really needed there?
Well, so we can't really know exactly where they were off until all the election data is final and we can look at the demographics and how the sampling and the polling averages differed from the actual results. Certainly, there was polling error. And what we can tell so far is that in the more Republican states, the polling error was higher. So the redder the state, the worse the polls were. They weren't as bad in the swing states. And in some states, they were pretty spot on. So there wasn't any sort of systematic error other than this general finding that we're seeing so far, which is in traditionally more Republican states, the polling error was worse. And that suggests that that the pollsters were missing a particular audience. One thing that we know for sure that it really isn't a function of sampling or polling error is that Trump successfully had a late surge. There was a rally, and we see this in some of the statistics, like the Arizona in-person votes right? Arizona is a state that votes mostly by mail anyways. They're a really good state to study because they didn't change a lot of their election laws like many other states did in preparation for the COVID pandemic. And so we saw there that the vote by mail, which is most of the Arizona vote, shifted toward the Democratic Party and toward Vice President Biden. But that early in-person voting, you could see this bump of support for Trump coming in. And then as we're seeing it actually shift back to Biden, and that's because those are they're late votes, but they're actually mail ballots. They're people that dropped off their mail ballots at the poll, sort of like many people did here in San Luis Obispo at voting centers.
I mean, one of the things from the layperson who's trying to understand polling, a little bit has to be given on margin of error that we don't talk a lot about, right? That a 3-point margin of error could mean a 6-point swing, right?
That's absolutely right. And I think those of you that are familiar with market research, sampling error is just part of the game. And so if in a presidential election or the winner is expected to get, a 7-point margin, well, that could also mean a 4-point margin, and that's millions and millions of votes.
Yeah, and you end up with some really interesting, again, especially when you have some of these anomalies, right, where huge turnout way beyond switching on both sides, right? Whether there was a huge turnout on the left or the right, you're not calculating all the unknowns in those things, which are almost impossible to predict.
Well, indeed. And, you know, if you think about it in a broader scientific perspective, science is about studying regularities and about looking at you know, what the average behavior is. And anytime that you have an election where it's ahistorical, and in this case, we're talking about the highest turnout in 120 years in this country. So you're bringing in all these new voters into the system. And by definition, that's going to make the polls noisier because they're shifting demographics, they're shifting partisan shifts because you're just bringing in people for whom there isn't previous data on.
Well, you brought up a great point there. You know, we saw the popular vote now, vote total crush any previous up for like the last 120 years in terms of percentage of people voting. So it you know, some might argue that, you know, that this is describing this overall participation rate is great. We're healthy. Wow, we're still the model of democracy for the world. But is there?
I wouldn't go that far.
Right. So that would be my question is, we're still only seeing like 60 something percent, right? Like participation. We still need to improve, right?
Absolutely. We're still, even at this very high turnout level, and we ought to be proud of that. I don't want it to depreciate the fact that millions of organizers and voters and I mean, this really is a shining example of democracy working in spite of the rules, not because of them. And so I think the broader point here is that turnout in the United States is pretty mediocre. It's among the lowest of all the developed advanced democracies. And it's primarily because of the rules. We put a lot of barriers in place to keep people from voting. And there's really no justification for them anymore. And California, frankly, does better than most other states. We have automatic voter registration. We have same-day registration. We have plenty of options for voters, in-person early voting, precinct voting, or vote by mail. And those are the kind of things that we need as national standards, because there's really no justification for the inequalities that we see across states. And that's where we see massive inequalities, states having, you know, 50% turnout to 70% turnout.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between the Slow Chambers' Jim D'Antona and Michael Lattner, a political science professor at Cal Poly.
And in looking at some of that, again, as the scientist, what states are examples that are kind of doing it right?
Well, so California, again, is a state that's doing a really good job in terms of having made some emergency changes, Governor Newsom's executive orders in the state legislature, we went to universal vote by mail this year for the first time. We were already kind of heading in that direction, but we've now, most counties have adopted and embraced this model, and I think it'll be here to stay, frankly. There'll probably be some more changes in the legislature, but the states that really do it best are those where Republicans and Democrats have come together and done bipartisan reform. States like Colorado is really the model system. They have universal vote by mail. They've broken down all the barriers to voting. And importantly, they have a really efficient administrative system that they've put in place. So they have best practices that they follow for early processing of ballots. They allow voters a chance to correct ballot errors, and they also provide a very unarbitrary system for verifying and validating ballots. It's not up to, you know, one dude in a basement sifting through ballots. They have high-tech machines, and for signature verification, they all of their workers go through extensive training to understand the process and to really put the onus on the administration rather than the voter to prove their accuracy. They make it easier for voters to verify and cure their ballots, and they really got a good system.
Can you shed some light on what like modern voter suppression looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. To your point, when we bring up the word voter suppression, we're often thinking of voter intimidation, right? And intimidation is the physical threat or threat of force against someone to keep them from voting. That's, you know, much less frequent than the sort of what I would call passive voter suppression, which is institutional. And that includes early restrictions on registration deadlines, really strict use and selective use of voter ID. So, you know, some states, your gun ID is enough to get you a ballot, but your student ID is not. And these are ways that are used to limit the opportunities for voters. Having deadlines for receiving ballots. Some of the big problems in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin are these deadlines that were imposed by these very gerrymandered legislatures. We knew that Pennsylvania was going to be a problem because the legislature didn't do what it needed to do and allow the local election officials to start processing those ballots early, like we do in California and Colorado and most other civilized states. We needed about $3.6 billion to provide the emergency infrastructure that was necessary to have a safe and secure election during a pandemic. And the Senate just completely failed to enact that legislation.
In terms of that, is that something we should be looking at as an infrastructure piece for our country, that voting and the vote tallies and all of the things that go with it should be part of our national infrastructure?
It absolutely is. All the roads that are ever going to be built, all of the health protections that will ever be put into law, all the things, the technology, all of that's a function of public policy. And that public policy is a function of who gets represented in state legislatures and in Congress. And so if our electoral infrastructure is not in good shape, of course we're going to have poor representation. That poor representation is going to lead to bias in legislatures and in Congress and the presidency. And that's going to have a distorting effect on the type of public policy that gets made. And there's a very clear direction public policy gets made in, and it is to the disadvantage of those who are not represented. And one of the reasons why we have the level of inequality that we do, why we have the racial disparities in health outcomes and environmental outcomes, is because the people that are suffering the burden of those poor policy decisions are not represented in their legislatures. And it really is a stain on our democracy.
How can we do that and still maintain that idea of the federal versus the state systems and giving the states the freedoms, but yet hold ourselves accountable to doing some real change?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. Federalism is both a bane and a beauty of our system, because on the one hand, many of the inequalities that we see across states are a function of, or a dysfunction of, federalism, I would argue. So you look at inequalities in education and health outcomes and these things across states, which are massive, and that's a function of states not being responsive. So I think the best solution to this is to not set hard lines on what states must do. I think that we can respect federalism, and we can set floors. We can set minimum standards to say that you've got to have your ballots processed within this much time. You can't have lines outside of precincts that are longer than half an hour. And however you want to fix it, fix it. You can, and we can use federalism, and we can allow states to innovate and come up with solutions to these problems, but we need to have minimal federal standards that ensures that every individual, regardless of where they live, has the equal opportunity to vote and have their vote counted.
Are there other countries that have great examples we should look to model in order to keep our democracy fresh and moving forward?
Sure. There are other countries and there are also states within the United States that apply best practices and we can learn from them. So again, I think federalism has an important role to play here. In terms of overall representation, there are absolutely countries that have much more accurate representation. And so in my view, in the work that I specialize in, redistricting and gerrymandering, one of the biggest problems that we have in this country is that we waste a lot of votes. Right. So in our single member district systems, Lude Carbajal is victorious, and that's great. But there are, 40% of voters who choose to be Republican and their votes are totally wasted. And there's no reason to do that. We can design systems so that everyone's vote can count and we can have a much more accurate representation of public preferences in Congress and as well as in our state legislatures. And we should be doing that. We should be moving towards more proportional voting systems, like the system that just passed up in Albany. And that's a growing movement across the states that we're seeing. And we should very much be looking at improving our instruments of democracy, again, as thinking about them in terms of infrastructure. And it doesn't matter what party you're from, we shouldn't be designing any kind of rules that advantage one party's voters over another. We should be designing systems that embody the procedure of political equality by weighting everyone's vote equally.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between the Slow Chambers, Jim D'Antona, and Michael Lattner, a political science professor at Cal Poly.
And you're on the front line of this. Do you have a few lines that you could talk about Albany's version of what they're doing to make people understand what maybe some of those fixes look like?
Sure. So their city, not unlike San Luis Obispo, was sued under the California Voting Rights Act because the plaintiffs argued that Asians and Latinos were underrepresented in their city council. And instead of moving toward a district system, which has been the dominant remedy, and what they did is set up a system called a single transferable vote. So they keep their at-large elections, they keep their multiple districts, every voter gets two or three districts every election cycle to vote for. But what they do is they rank choice their candidates. And by using a ranked choice method, it prohibits the plurality from dominating every seat, which is what the current system in San Luis Obispo and in the previous system in Albany does, where, one plurality of voters, they can use all three of their votes to capture all three seats. Ranked choice voting prevents that. It allows minority representation, and it has the additional benefit of not ossifying politics in this district method. So if you're, whatever you're doing with redistricting, if you're districting for racial purposes to get racial representation or partisan representation, you can do that by drawing the lines, but then you're also sort of ossifying that conflict within the city council. The advantage of ranked choice voting in a multi-district system is that it allows for minority representation of whatever minority is politically relevant, whether it's a pro-growth or an anti-growth element or an LGBTQ issue or movement that might not be geographically segregated and which might actually be hurt or diluted once we adopt a district system. So I think of adopting districts as kind of like chemotherapy, right? I mean, if you've got cancer and you've got some real problems of representation, districts can fix it, but they come with a lot of side effects.
And so bringing it back locally, Paso just had their first districted elections.
That's right. Yeah, I think Paso is a really good example of what tends to happen. So in that case, you had a demographer come in, they drew their districts to try to increase Latino representation. They didn't really increase Latino representation, they preserved it, but more than anything, they preserved the incumbency of the sitting council members. And that's what tends to happen in a district system, is that you tend to get safe districts where one incumbent dominates the district and can stay in power for quite some time. Whereas, and I think Paso's a pretty good example where you don't really have the sort of concentrated segregation that you would need to have like a majority-minority community. You can't do that. There's no way to draw a district that you get a majority of Latinos that can choose their own candidate. Instead, you can get a plurality district or an influence district. And that's better than the old system. It's certainly better than an at-large plurality system. But it definitely ends up wasting the votes of Latinos if there is that kind of racial block voting where all Latinos are supporting, one set of candidates versus another. It dilutes the votes of those that don't end up inside the district because then they'll never end up electing their candidate of choice. The 2020 election taught us nothing else. It certainly suggests that Latinos are not a monolithic voting group and we ought not to treat them as such. And it's even more the case with Asian Americans. When you look at the Asian vote in California, it's quite diverse in terms of their partisan preferences and their policy preferences. And so the idea that we can just, you know, draw a district around a particular racial group to guarantee racial representation, that process just doesn't work as well in California, where you don't have the segregation and you frankly have a much more diverse set of opinions.
As you look to the future, what are your hopes for our local political process, or maybe even our state and federal processes?
Well, I'm really hoping, and I've been on this horse for a while, but my personal politics are probably left of center compared to, you know, many other Californians even. But I think that we do ourselves a disservice by having such a dominant one-party system in this state. And I've been arguing for many years that the Republicans ought to be the party of reform in California, because they're getting their teeth kicked in every statewide election. And it's not from gerrymandering, because we have an independent redistricting commission that actually does a very good job of drawing unbiased districts. But because we still use single member districts, even if you have an unbiased plan, the largest party in that system ends up getting a big seat bonus. And so in the 2018 elections, I haven't done the math for 2020 yet, but in 2018, the Republican Party got about a third of the statewide vote. They're the minority party, but they only got 13% of the congressional seats. And that's not because of gerrymandering. That's because the system is responsive to the largest party. And there's really no need for that either. It's a different type of bias, but it's bias nonetheless. And it means that your vote counts for less depending on which party you vote on. And there's really no need for that.
It suppresses votes for those people who are like, my vote doesn't count, right? I mean, you ended up back to that point.
It does. And we know, at least historically, when we look at the South and we look at, you know, other dominant one party regimes, that tends to not be good in terms of public policy. Corruption is sort of inevitable when a party doesn't have to be responsive to its constituents.
So obviously during COVID here, have you found any kind of silver linings or changes that have occurred because of the pandemic that maybe you hope become permanent?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the emergency procedures that were put into place will stick. So, you know, obviously, Tommy Gong was hesitant to move into a voting center system prior to the pandemic. And so, you know, a lot of county clerk recorders sort of had their hands forced during this election cycle, frankly. But we did what we had to do. And we now have a model set up that I think will be better than the older model. Turnout looks like it was pretty astronomical in San Luis Obispo. And, you know, there are definitely kinks to work out. But again, I think the more options that you provide voters, the better off you are for all voters, because you're giving people an option to vote multiple ways and you're making it easier. You're removing those barriers. And by removing those barriers, you're going to increase participation.
Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate you spending the time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona speaking with Cal Poly professor Michael Lattner, who is working on a new book called Gerrymandering the States, Race, Partisanship, and the Rewriting of American Federalism. Next, we'll hear from Paul Monroe from the nonprofit BraveMove.org. Monroe is speaking with KCBX contributor Brian Reynolds about what led him to teaching and the work he does to help others succeed.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio over the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Paul Monroe, a special education teacher and executive director of the nonprofit BraveMove.org. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Brian.
It's very exciting having gotten to know you recently and to be able to talk today on the radio about a couple of topics that you're expert at, helping children flourish in all ways, and of course, special ed and the activities of Brave Move covered that ground pretty well. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from and how you got to your current jobs and your responsibilities?
Well, I'm actually from Pomona and then off to San Jose State University. And then from there, I worked in the area of probation, in juvenile probation at boys' ranches and juvenile halls. And from there, I moved on to adult probation when I moved out to Arizona. Due to some of the interviews I had and how I was feeling at the time, I just left that profession and wanted to get into teaching. So I started becoming a substitute teacher, and I did that for about 3 years. Then I decided to make the plunge to become credentialed, and then I went to Cal Poly to get my master's in special education. And now I currently teach and am currently executive director of Brave Move.
When you were you a teacher, did you teach a general population before deciding to go into special ed?
I taught at a continuation school.
Uh-huh.
And they just learn differently. And a lot of teachers really haven't found out how to really reach them.
Yes.
So they've kind of been left behind and kind of fell through the cracks. So they end up at these types of schools where teachers come in and out so much. And it's kind of rare when someone like me kind of steps in. And I don't mind that environment, because I think working in boys' branches and things, it kind of prepared me for classrooms, because when you're working in an environment, in a locked environment with kids, the same things happen. You know, kids don't want to be embarrassed and things like that. So,
of course, a kid's a kid, huh? You know,
a kid's a kid.
It's kind of sad or ironic to me that these young people who, for a variety of reasons, probably most of them not their fault, they have behaved in such a way that they've landed in a precarious position. But the irony is that they need help and intervention all the more because of all the circumstances. And so, really, it's an amazing need and wonderful that people like yourself are dedicated and to do that and have the resources and the courage, because certainly these young people need help.
I have this motto that I use when I do, when I'm teaching kids and dealing with kids, is I say that kids don't care what you think unless they think that you care. And I really truly believe that. But if you really give them the time and invest in them, that they will work for you. And I think people teach us how to treat them. And I think kids also teach you how to teach them. But it just takes time and patience to figure it out.
Could we talk a little bit about the special education, the discipline that you do, and some of your challenges there pre-COVID and now during COVID, and how that might have changed?
Well, some of the challenges I've had mostly would be keeping kids totally engaged in school. And I work with a population, ED, emotional disturbed kids, who really have a hard time sitting still in class and staying focused for long periods of time. So finding ways to utilize your time in class with them to make it productive is a challenge every day, because how you carry the day is really going to depend on how they come in emotionally. That's going to affect their learning. We don't know things that have gone on at the home or before school that have really got them to a space where they really can't focus. So being able to have empathy and a lot of intuitiveness, just to really be able to break down what's really going on with the kid that's in the way of them learning. Because the issue with some of these children, I think their behavior has caused them to miss so much school that their academics suffer.
Right. In many cases, depending on how old they are or what's going on, it's hard to catch up.
And that's the biggest problem, because once you get to sixth or seventh grade, it becomes really hard to hide the fact that you don't know how to read or that you don't know basic math.
Right.
And so your kids start to figure that out, and they start to make fun of you and tease you. And working in probation, I've seen people 30 years old, 35 years old, might say to someone, well, ha ha, that's why you couldn't read in the eighth grade. And that might trigger something where someone might get hurt.
Right.
So this will carry with people throughout their life, and people don't realize it.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Contributor Brian Reynolds is speaking with Paul Monroe of BraveMove.org.
I'm going to propose a little hypothesis and see if you think it's a valid one, that if you have 10 kids in a room, each one of them is going to be a little different in their personality and their needs, and maybe 10 different or 11 different approaches by the teacher. And a lot of times we know in a standard classroom, the teacher has to teach to the middle. The kids who are way ahead of the curve are bored and kind of rambunctious, and the kids who are struggling are, they're not bored, but they're desperate and they can act up too. But because you don't have 10 teachers, each one working with a child, you've got to make some compromises. I'm guessing that it's even more difficult with kids with emotional or other cognitive problems. How do you address their individual needs when there's just one of you?
I think differentiation and knowing your students on a really personal basis. That's why I say it's so important to know your student and how they learn, because your job is actually to remediate. You need to see where they are, And then you need to bridge that gap between what they do know and what they should know. And then while you're teaching, you have to continuously assess. You have to adjust. You may need to improve in some places. You might need to speed up. You might need to slow down. You might need to change your mode of presentation. So it's very true what you said. Some kids are way ahead of the curve. So what do you do to keep them occupied, you know, without letting them just go off on their own and teach themselves? You still have to teach the middle of the pack for the kids who are right on pace. And then you still have to go back to the kids who might need to hear that lesson 3, 4, maybe 5 times. You know, some kids might be able to get through a lesson in 1 or 2 days. Some kids might take a whole week. But kids today, they're visual and they're tactile. They need to see it and they need to touch it. And so it's different than I grew up. My teacher might say, hey, take this book, read 3 chapters. Here's your test. You give a kid a book today and they look at you like, what just happened? Because they're used to scrolling on phones and iPads.
Right.
And they think differently. And so the way you have to give them that information is different. And that's why in my classes, even though when I'm on computers all the time, what I would do was I would break my classes up into 20-minute intervals, because it was very hard to get a student to sit through math for a whole hour. So I would teach the same subject of math 3 different ways in 20-minute intervals. I might teach it one way for 20 minutes and then say, okay, let's take a 10-minute break. And then the same thing, I'll teach it a different way with, you know, things I can move with their hands. And then the third time, I'll teach it another way. But that's my way of getting them to have that hour of math without going straight through and them getting anxious and getting bored, and behaviors come up when they don't know something. Like I mentioned before, not knowing the basics make math and English really hard, especially when you get into word problems and things like that.
Right. What have been some of the biggest changes and or challenges in this remote learning situation with COVID?
I think the biggest challenge, I think, is holding some parents accountable, because we can't turn the computer on for the child. We can get them and they can come on, but if the parents aren't making them do the work or holding them accountable or leaving everything to the teacher, that's very difficult.
Right.
It's very difficult. Because if the parent doesn't take it seriously, then the child most likely isn't going to take it seriously. And it's very easy for a kid to just turn off the computer. And then what do? And then you have to start calling parents. You're hoping he gets back on to try to engage. But it's just very difficult when you're not actually there in the midst of everything.
As I taught online for the graduate level for a few years, and it's way different from inside the classroom. But one of the biggest differences is both the teacher and the student have to be more self-sufficient, just dedicated and methodical. And with a little child, that'd be hard. I'd like to remind everybody, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Paul Monroe, a special education teacher and executive of nonprofit bravemove.org. Paul, let's talk about Brave Move. The more you've talked to me about it, the more amazed I am. Just walk me into the history of how it began and broadly speaking, what you guys accomplished.
Oh, you know, Brave Move started with myself speaking of something. Originally, I wanted to help out veterans, and that's where the name Brave Move came from. It stood for an acronym, Bolstering Resilience Among Veterans Everywhere, Maximizing Opportunities and Volunteering Experiences. And when I first started, a lot of people were thought, oh, well, veterans, it's the military. But it wasn't that. Veterans can be from any field, any form of any career, engineering, teaching, scientists. And then it kind of evolved. I was doing a program, a re-beautification program for a church up in the Bay Area. And then once that finished, like I mentioned before, I got the call to come and teach and finally get my credential. So I came down here, finished all that, and then it kind of got put on hold until the recent, I guess, if you want to call them unrests or different things that have happened in society with George Floyd and other people. And we just thought, wow, you know, there has to be something that we can do now to bring this back and to help more people, because that seems to be the problem. It seems that people are needing lots of help, and not due because they're not trying, but because there's so many barriers in the way, because we've heard all the talk about systemic racism. So that's where we come along and we kind of revamped Brave Move from just helping either veterans into just helping everyone, no matter who you are. And what we do is we actually pair people with companies, organizations, and individuals who want to help, but don't know what to do or where to start. And so we actually help identify and remove systemic barriers to careers and education to help people become agents of change. And to give an example, we help come alongside organizations to help them be successful, because there's so many great programs out there that people fall through because due to unforeseen barriers. And that's where we want to come in.
I know we've talked about this, but tell us a little more about the we, you and your friends from high school.
Yeah, these are friends from high school. Everyone on our board, I've grown up with and played football with. So we've known each other for over 25 years, 30 years. And we just know each other so well. We know each other's likes and dislikes. We know each other's families. And we kind of all have the same goal, which is just to help people. So we just wanted to start this as kind of a grassroots organization and keep it very qualitative and not quantitative, so that we can really make an impact in all the people that we touch. Because that's what I found at looking at different organizations, is everyone just got so big and they put everybody in the same category. And I was like, well, there's got to be some individual needs somewhere where they don't fit into that mode. And how do we help these people?
We talked a little bit also earlier about how the connection is forged or created and maintained, if you will, among the three partners. That'd be Brave Move, folks like yourself, a program that a person is involved with, and then the person. And you showed me a video recently about Chelsea and the Cyber Mandela mm-hmm. training program. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yes. That Cyber Mandela program is a program in Oakland, California. It's a 16-week program. That's actually free. It's a 16-week pre-apprenticeship program for Bay Area men and women age 18 and over. It's hands-on in the classroom and prepares people for skilled trades of today. It's free of charge, and it's Monday through Friday from 7 a.m. to 3:30. And all they need to do is just go there, sign up, and they can be in the program. The issues they have is, which is how we approach them, so many people have to leave that program because not many people can afford to not work for 16 weeks while they attend this free program.
Right. And you had made contact with that group, and they basically asking if they had some folks who were at risk.
Yeah, because it's a fantastic program that I've known about for a few years. And I've always thought, why isn't this program bigger? And then the more I've got to learn about the program, I got to learn that there were so many people that come through there, but there's so many people that drop out because of unforeseen barriers, whether it be childcare or transportation. And that actually doesn't help anybody be successful. It makes them go backwards. And this isn't a knock on fast food companies or anything like that, but put this in perspective. You know, if I'm in that program and I've now gone through there for 8 or 9 weeks, and now it's just been so hard to not work, I might have to take another job at, say, McDonald's or 7-Eleven to make those ends meet. So now I'm in a training program from 7 a.m. to 3:30, which is free, but now I've got to work from 4 p.m. or 4:30 p.m. until midnight just to make ends meet while I'm trying to get through the program that's going to guarantee me a stable employment. So those kids that have to drop out to make that extra money, like at a fast food place, those are the ones that we really need to keep hold of and say, look, don't go take that mediocre job now. What do you need to help you be successful? And in the instance of Chelsea, you know, she had about, I think, 9 weeks left in that program. And she was in danger of dropping out because, you know, the place she was living, she said, wasn't very safe. She didn't feel comfortable there, and issues with transportation. So we were like, look, we don't want her to drop out of that program. So when we approached Cyrus Mandela, we said, who do you have that's in danger of leaving your program, but not due to effort or determination, but just due to unforeseen barriers that they couldn't help to help them be successful. And then the director went in the back and he came back with Chelsea. And she was in danger of leaving the program. She had 9 weeks left. She had a problem with housing. And so we said, okay, we want to help her right now. So that day, we have a relationship with an executive suites where we get a rate and we set her up and we pay for her to live there until she graduated the program. And then, and right now we're in the process of helping her just kind of stay grounded while she starts her internship in February at a reputable company in the Bay Area.
What would be some things you'd like to tell the public about kids today and what we can do as parents and what we might do to help organizations like Brave Move?
I think listen to kids. Listen to kids because, like I mentioned earlier in the show, people teach us how to treat them. And I think kids teach you how to treat them. Help them evolve and grow in whatever they're interested in. So, for instance, when this distance learning first started, a lot of people were so worried that kids were going to lose a lot of information, whether math or English and things like that. Yeah, that's going to be a gap. Kids are going to lose some things, but there's always learning opportunities. And that could be another opportunity to say, maybe teach the kid how to balance a checkbook. Maybe teach the kid how to change the oil in the car or change the tire. There's other things you can do social skills-wise, but you're still learning and teaching them things. Move everything to a positive. That's how I think. I have to remain positive every single day because as a special education teacher, my job is to adapt to the student and meet them where they are and help them learn. And that's the same thing we do, I think, with Brave Move is we kind of meet people where they're at and we build, whether it be the scholarship or what type of help or assistance, around the individual.
I'd like to thank you for being here today. This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. And we were discussing special education teachers and the wonderful nonprofit organization bravemove.org with Paul Monroe, a local teacher and executive director of Brave Move. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
And finally, many on the Central Coast book airline tickets through hubs like Los Angeles or San Francisco. But how safe are those larger airports? KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer takes a look at COVID-19 holiday travel precautions at the San Francisco International Airport.
I'm Doug Yackel. I'm the airport spokesman for the San Francisco International Airport. And we're here today to talk a little bit about how the airport's adjusting to the COVID-19 pandemic.
How are you? What are you doing most important, most essential?
So I think really what we're focused on is the health and safety of passengers and employees. Mm-hmm. Early on when stay-at-home orders went into effect, the airport was one of those facilities that was defined as essential, so it needs to remain open. So really the obligation is to ensure that the people that are using this airport can stay safe.
It would seem to me that the two essential variables that you guys can enforce and enhance, and that's spacing, physical distance between one another, and mask wearing.
Absolutely.
Talk to us about how you make that happen and enforce.
So SFO was actually the first major airport in the U.S. to make facial coverings or face masks a requirement in all of its terminals, and it really forced us to think about what do we need to do to ensure that everybody's complying with that. And for us, the solution really took two different forms. One of them was, especially in the early days, we knew that not everyone yet had their own face masks, so we needed to make it easy for people to get face masks. So in all of our terminals, we have stations set up that can pass them out for free. Yeah. We actually give out about 300 masks per day, and it's given both to airport employees and to passengers. We don't differentiate between the two. If you need one, you'll get one. In the larger picture, it really helps everybody. So that was one thing. And then the other thing is we created a program that we call Ambassadors. These are airport employees that normally perform a different job here at the airport, but for a few hours a day, they are scheduled to walk around all of our terminals to help ensure that people are meeting those face mask requirements. And that was really important because if you think about it, there's parts of the country where the expectation may have been different. Maybe it's getting more consistent now, but we'd have people maybe flying in from a different part of America where a face mask wasn't required. So the focus really was on information and education. And as we measure it now, we're at about 99% compliance. So we've had really good support. And you know, part of what helps that is the fact that you need to wear it on board the aircraft. It's already part of what people expect nowadays in travel.
Right. And that's not an option. That's
exactly. 100%. It's a requirement. Yeah. Exactly.
You read about United promoting about their cleaning enhancement, their HEPA filters, and how their aircraft inside, they say, is as safe as a hospital operating room.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know I certainly get asked from friends and family about my own comfort level. And having worked for airlines and having researched this years ago, I can tell them that the cabin of an aircraft actually has better air quality than most indoor facilities because the rate of air recirculation is so much greater. And then, as you say, the air is being passed through hospital-grade HEPA filters, and you're in a place now where everybody has to wear a face mask at all times. So it's a pretty safe environment.
I tell people I feel more safe on an airliner than I do in the grocery store.
Exactly, yeah.
Other angles and aspects of how your world has changed in the midst of COVID.
You know, a lot of times you encounter a situation like this and you appreciate things in a new way. And for us, over the last 10 years, we've really been focused on renovating our facilities, renovating our terminals. And anytime we do a project like that, we're always expanding the footprint. And we're so thankful that we did that because we really need more space to spread out now. Right now, we're only seeing about 25% of the passenger activity that we should be seeing at this time of year. So there's plenty of space right now, but we need to think about what is it like when we're at 50% or 75%?
Right.
And having these larger facilities with all this room to spread out, we're really glad we did a lot of those renovation projects. The real next frontier, and we're just starting to touch on this now, is this whole nexus of some type of health certification, some type of testing capacity before you get on the airplane. And I liken this a lot to after 9/11, some of the changes that went into effect at airports around security, where everybody had to go through a same type of process before you ever get on the aircraft. And I think we're probably heading in that direction more from a health consideration now.
And that's pre-testing?
Exactly. So right now it would be, and we're already testing this in certain markets. We launched this to Hawaii in order to allow passengers to bypass quarantine. But I think we're heading down the path of COVID-free flights where people don't even get on the aircraft until they've been confirmed as negative. So right now, that'd be a negative test result. I think we're heading to a place where once a vaccine's available, a traveler will either show proof of a vaccination or proof of a negative test result before they're allowed on board an aircraft.
As you know, I just flew in moments ago from Papeete in Tahiti.
Right.
And a requirement to fly on United to Papeete was a negative test result from a certified lab, not a home test.
That's right.
Within 3 days of travel. And then on the ground, they require and they issue you a self-administered test 4 days on the ground. And you swab your nose and then a second swab in your mouth.
Right.
And then that's sent into a lab in Tahiti. And if you flunk, you got to stay 14 more days in Tahiti, which isn't too bad a punishment.
There are worse ways to spend two weeks, right?
And it's interesting, people in the hotel industry explain that the government, they're so sensitive and so dialed in on their tourism that they have subsidized your stay if you test positive. So your hotel or apartment rate is very affordable.
Interesting.
Because they don't want to make it a deal breaker for you financially if you're stuck there.
You're listening to KCBX, and this is Issues and Ideas. Correspondent Tom Wilmer is speaking with Doug Yackel with the San Francisco International Airport.
It seems to me you're talking about traffic being down so much here that it would be an excellent time to do renovation projects. Just because of that. I mean, less conflict of
people. It is. And honestly, we're doing a bit of both. We are accelerating some work and we're holding off on others. Because you're right, having empty facilities presents a great opportunity. And earlier this year, we actually closed half of our international terminal and accelerated a lot of recarpeting, repainting, relighting, improvements to moving walkways. And these are things that would have taken much longer if we were trying to work around passengers, but being able to close it down completely, we got a lot done.
What are some of the things that you put on hold and why would you?
So some of the projects that we did put on hold are very expensive capital projects to renovate other facilities. One of the big projects we put on hold was the renovation of Terminal 3 where United Airlines operates. This would have been a $1 billion renovation project. And one of the things we need to be thinking about is the amount of debt that the airport takes on in doing such a project. Normally, we've got passenger activity, we've got revenues coming in that can offset that debt, but with the sharp decline in activity, we also have a sharp decline in our revenues. And so we really need to be balancing that decline with what kind of debt we're taking on. So we've made some decisions in projects that are already underway to continue with them and finish them out. The new Harvey Milk Terminal 1 is a great example of facilities where we're going to continue a couple of phases. We'll probably postpone the final phase, but then there's other projects like this renovation in Terminal 3 where we hadn't yet brought construction workers on site. We hadn't yet started the entire process, the flow of materials and labor, and it was really the right time to say, let's call a timeout before we take on this $1 billion burden. You know, we talked a little bit about testing, and we're really trying to help lead the way in identifying what the new normal will look like. So we were the first airport to create an on-site rapid testing facility, and initially we created it for airport workers to use. We then expanded it for United to use for their Hawaii-bound passengers.
So if I want to travel to Hawaii, I can come to the airport. What do you have to allow time?
So right now, a lot of this is being made available through your airline. So if you're flying on United, United gives you one of two options. And of course, you could always get the testing done through your own health provider. But United also offers the options of either using a drive-through testing facility that's just north of SFO.
It's operated by United?
It's operated by a third-party health vendor under contract with United. You could either use that or you could use the on-site rapid testing facility here at SFO.
And how fast do the results come back?
So the drive-through is done about 2 to 3 days prior, and the on-site is done the day that you travel. And the on-site test, you'll get the result in less than an hour.
Wow, that's great.
So it's really intended that you show up a little earlier before your flight, you get the test, you're confirmed as negative, and you're on your way to Hawaii.
What's the fee for that?
So the cost for that right now is, I believe it's $250. Okay. I'll have to double check that. But
well, I got caught a little short going to Tahiti. You have to test within this 3-day window.
Okay.
But I went and called my doctor and I go, well, it could be 3-4 days before you get the results. We can't guarantee.
Right.
That means I have to cancel the whole trip. So the nearest facility that could promise a 1-day turnaround was in Santa Barbara and it was $250. So that must be the going rate for
that. Yeah, that seems to be the price nowadays. But I think as these tests become more readily available, I think you're going to see it become more cost effective as it really starts making its way around the industry. And that's really the challenge is how do airports across the U.S. scale this to a point where everybody can do it easily and at an affordable price?
Right. And that's a factor. I mean, for a lot of people, it's a choker just paying the airfare,
sure.
And then you layer on these other ancillary costs and it can change your mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If somebody wanted to learn more about SFO and especially as it relates to the world we're in right now, COVID world, where would you direct them?
So probably the best resource is our website. It's flysfo.com. And right on our homepage, you'll see a section called Travel Well. And that really will give you all the information you need to know about current health measures in place and what to expect when you're traveling these days.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from San Francisco International Airport.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.